Здравствуйте и добро пожелайте в писательский блог. Здесь со мной товарищ Усилия, and that's about all the Russian I'm allowed to speak before representatives of the Federal Security Bureau bust down my door for crimes against the Russian language. And with me here, I have Endeavor, and we're going to be discussing Russian stuff. And speaking of Russia, you know what's really characteristic of Russia? Wherever you go in Russia, it's cold out there. And here on the writer's block, we fight against the cold with Alaska Chaga. Alaska Chaga, the NFT that just keeps on giving the nice jungle tea, which keeps me well-oiled machine, podcasting machine, article writing machine, and just makes those long Russian winters pass by so well. If I could live stream smell, folks, if I could live stream smell. With me tonight, I have Endeavor, and he is calling. He is with us from lovely, frozen, minus 20 degrees, St. Petersburg, Russia. How do you do, Endeavor?
Здравствуйте, меня зовут Endeavor. Я родился в Канаде, но сейчас я живу в Санкт-Петербург. Hello, my name is Endeavor. I was born in Canada, but I'm currently living in St. Petersburg. I've mentioned it online a few times, and I've gotten a lot of questions about Russia on, you know, from my people who watch my channel. So I thought, it would be cool to do this stream. It was Nick's idea, but yeah, I agreed to it.
Well, I had known for some time now that Endeavor was out wrestling the bears in the frozen wastes of Velikaya Rus, but I waited until he himself shared this information so it wouldn't be doxing. But I have a fascination with Russia. I've never been to Russia. I don't speak the language. I look Russian. Everyone thinks I'm Russian. You know, when I'm on vacation, people say to me, Rus, Rus, but I just shake my head and say, well, technically, yeah, but, and I'm also of partial Russian descent, of white Russians, boyars and knyazes and all sorts of counter-revolutionary elements who got away with Admiral Vrangel, but I've never been to the country. And I'm interested in what goes on over there all the time. Now, there might have been some rumblings in the Ukraine, although that might be just the sausages. And here I have someone who, well, is a friend of the show, has been on the writer's block before, and will be on the writer's block again, hopefully. And, you know, he's in Russia, so let's see what the man has to say. But first of all, let me inform our esteemed viewership that aside from entropystream.live/countercurrents, where you can send us super chats, and Endeavor and I will endeavor to answer all of your questions correctly and entirely, you can now also donate to Countercurrents through MoonPay. Now, MoonPay is one of these newfangled technologies, and I'm just going to put the Entropy banner over there. MoonPay is one of these newfangled technologies which allows you to convert fiat currency, your hard-earned denge, into crypto, and you can, of course, send that crypto to countercurrents.com. You can just choose your fiat currency, and with your credit card, transfer it into crypto and send that crypto to countercurrents.com. And if our heroic moderators, if our glorious comrades moderators would just post MoonPay link in chat, that would be greatly appreciated and rewarded with double portions of vodka. And I'm dropping the ridiculous accent right now. And of course, I think you people, loyal viewers of the show, will know that Countercurrents is sprinting for the finish line of the fundraiser. Last time we checked, there's like maybe $3,000-$4,000 missing. We got 5 days to cover it to reach our goal of $200,000 raised in the year of our Lord 2021. So if you would just dash over to Entropy, MoonPay, we even accept lemons on DLive. You can also donate lemons, diamonds, ninja genies, ice creams, and all sorts of their weird China currency here on DLive. If you would do that, that would be greatly appreciated. And of course, you can attach questions to your entropy chats. So I will be able to read and answer them. And of course, Endeavor will help me with that. Now, with that being said, Endeavor, I wanna give you the field. Tell me about your. Let's talk about your first impressions about Russia when you first came in from Canada. What was the first thing that struck you about this strange land of the Rus?
Well, I guess I'll first tell people why and how I actually got here. Basically, I'm from Toronto, like I've mentioned many times. And around 2019, I had already been doing my channel for a couple of years at that point. I was just not really doing too well with work and stuff. I wasn't really happy. Wasn't really going anywhere. So I decided to do a work contract in Russia, in St. Petersburg, because I just love the history, the culture. St. Petersburg in particular is just such a beautiful city, such a fascinating place, and I just wanted to do something different. So that was in 2019 when I first got here, and then also I wanted to learn the Russian language. Now I'm actually not great at it. I'd say I'm like intermediate level. So I think to the average Russian, I probably sound like the Chinese guy at the market saying, "You buy fish, $2 only. It's really good deal. Your wife really like make good dinner." I think I probably sound like that to Russian people. But yeah, I'm kind of proud of my achievements in that regard. It's not an easy language to learn, definitely. But I've made a lot of progress on it. But anyway, so then COVID happened in 2020, as everyone knows, and I basically had a choice. Do I want to stay in Russia or go back to Canada? And this was when we didn't even know. We didn't know whether it was going to be like Black Plague 2.0 or something like that, and there'd be dead bodies in the streets. Obviously, that didn't happen. But I made the decision that I'd say, okay, it's going to be hell getting there and back. I don't know what's going to happen. Also, I kind of just assumed the Canadian government would do something retarded with COVID, which they did. So I predicted that correctly. So I just decided to do another work contract. And then as the flu world order materialized, I thought, oh crap, I'm kind of in a bit of a situation here that I'm pretty much, I guess, an exile. Because I mean, I don't even know how I could possibly even get back to Canada now. So yeah, that's been my life for the last, over 2 years now, actually. So my first impressions when I got to Russia were, first of all, was the, with St. Petersburg is just how beautiful the city is, that everywhere you look, it's this beautiful architecture everywhere, so much history. I'm from the suburbs in Toronto. So, a place where you got a bunch of houses and shopping malls and stuff like that. But yeah, like St. Petersburg really was something else, like this beautiful historical site. And, Toronto right now, like today, is just a bunch of glass and steel towers covering it up. It used to be a really nice looking city. But the first thing was how nice the architecture was, and just how much history it was steeped in. And then secondly, how many white people there were. Like when I got there, I was shocked that I had never been around so many white people in my life. Like I went into a McDonald's and then almost everyone in the McDonald's was white. And I'm like, oh my God, I this is unbelievable. Because I mean, I just a couple of weeks earlier, I had been into McDonald's where then there was a couple of, urban youths having a chair fight, an after school chair fight at McDonald's. That was a pretty big change as well. And then also, like culture shock. So I had started studying Russian before I came here, but I was terrible at it when I first got here. So, having to study that and having to learn things, and then, having to find new friends and stuff, but it's worked out for me. I like what I do. I mean, the other thing is that, you don't need to worry about like getting fired from your job for being an internet racist or something like that. That's not, that stress is gone. And then also just how affordable it is, really. Like, it's really easy to afford everything. This is the second apartment I've lived in here, but I live in a Khrushchev era apartment building. It's really, really cool. It's not the nicest in the city. I mean, it's not like the old Imperial buildings, which are, you know, absolutely beautiful. But, you know, it has character of its own. And, you know, for what it's worth, you know, a two-bedroom place. Not, I mean, they're not, it's not huge, but you got a lot of space. And it's affordable, you know. It's something that you can, that you know, it doesn't take up your entire salary a month to rent on rent. And you can actually have like a good, you know, easy job. And you don't need to spend a huge commute. You don't need to
affordable housing.
Spend hours and hours, and the housing's affordable. So, you know, that's that's my first impression. That's why I'm still here, is that it's also just really really comfortable living, because it's affordable, really.
That's very interesting, right? People in the chat are saying comfy Khrushchevka. I hope it's not in a Khrushchevka. These are actually very low built.
No, it's a Khrushchevka, but it's actually, I like it though. It has like a character of its own. It's not one of the like really crappy ones. Like, I think that on the street that I'm on, the crosswalk that I live on, this is the first Khrushchevkas. Before that are Stalinkas. These are Stalin era buildings. And those ones are a lot nicer looking than the Khrushchevkas. It's funny how, like, you know, the further, the more recent the architecture is, the shittier it is. It's like that in Russia too, for the most part. But no, the area is nice though, for what it's worth. It's a nice looking place. You do feel like, you know, it's kind of like the Soviet era neighborhood, but, you know, a lot better than living in like one of the new developments, where they call it Chilovinyk, if I'm pronouncing that right. They call it the human anthill. So like at the outskirts of the city, you'll get these huge like 20 story buildings, which are just like, there must be tens of thousands of people living in one of them. And it's just depressing as hell. Like you wouldn't wish that on your worst enemy.
Seen those in a film, right? There is a Russian film which they watch on New Year's Eve, Ironia Sudbe, and it's actually full of an ancestry's my friend and former co-host of the Writer's Block. It's his favorite film, but interestingly enough, he turned me on to it. And you see these things in the film, and they're huge. And we have, you know, big, tall buildings here in Macedonia too, from the communist period, but not that big, right? There is something about buildings when they exceed a certain size that makes them just alienating. Like, these are no longer buildings fit for human habitation. It's like some sort of giant lives there, right?
Yeah.
But it's not. It's thousands of humans.
Yeah. So what was the when did that movie come out, the one that Full Moon likes? I've heard of it. I haven't seen it myself.
In the 70s.
Okay, yeah. So no, the ones that are built now, like no, these ones dwarf those. So those would be tiny in comparison. Yeah. They're actually being built right now. That's pretty depressing, actually. The further away you go, it's kind of weird, because in North America, all the cities, like the city centers, are shitholes. But then you go into the suburbs and it's quite nice. You know, you got the standalone houses, you got the parks, and some community centers and stuff. But then it's actually the opposite in Europe. It's that the city center is really nice, but then the further away you go, the worse it gets. But no, if you want to see like what something that would probably inspire me to write a sci-fi dystopia futurist novel or something, type in Parnas. It's pronounced Parnas in Russian. Type that in on Google and you'll see, it's like the human anthill. Like, you talk about getting in the pod, like that's what the pods are going to look like.
What did you call it? Chovyalnik?
Chilovinyk. I don't know if I'm pronouncing
Chilovinyk. Right.
What that means, Chilovinyk. Yeah, Chilovinyk means person. And what it's saying is like, it's a person anthill.
Yeah, I know. I understand the logic of the word, because in Macedonian, we say mravyalnik for an anthill. And yeah. So this, it would be chovek, chovilnik in Macedonian, but this is chelovieknil, I think. if you write it out, I'll be able to see it. See, a lot of people assume I speak Russian because, and if it's spoken very slowly and it's very simple Russian, I will understand about 70% of it. Or written Russian, I understand like 70% of written Russian. But yeah, it's one of those things. But yeah, it's sad to.
I'm terrible at reading it. I can speak it pretty well, understanding it not too badly, but reading it, I'm terrible at. But yeah, sorry. Yeah, what were you saying?
Yeah, but you have the Cyrillic alphabet. You've not been raised with it.
Yeah. So
yeah, because in Macedonian we use the Cyrillic alphabet, so it's basically the same thing with some exceptions. We are, however, doing this stream in English because, like I said, if I try to speak Russian, the FSB will bust down my door and probably kill me. I'm just that bad at it. And we have a lemon from Max Moon who says a lemon drop. Well, it's actually a diamond. Sorry. It's a diamond. Eto diamant. And he says lemon drop. And 1001 Cuts has donated 8 ice creams. Well, thank you for that, kind sirs. Thank you. Your contributions have been acknowledged and they are appreciated. Now, Endeavor, that's Petersburg. That's St. Petersburg, Petrograd, and formerly Leningrad. And it's a nice city, but we know from Oswald Spengler that it's a pseudomorphous city, that it's a city which the Russians built when they were LARPing as Germans under Peter the Great. Now, have you been to the Russian city? Have you been to Moscow? And what can you give us any impressions of Moscow?
Yes, I have. I've only been there once, and it was about 2 years ago. It was more than that now. It's summer 2019. I went to Moscow. It's beautiful as well. It's tons of history. It's incredible how huge it is. Like, I will say that size-wise, it absolutely dwarfs St. Petersburg. Like, you just get if you're on, the main boulevard or Red Square, or I think the most striking image for me was, like, when you see Red Square from the bridge, you just get struck by just the feeling of power, really. It's just enormous how huge it is. And all the boulevards, just enormous. And yeah, you know, it's a nice place to visit. I wouldn't want to live there, just because of how it's more expensive, more busy, more crowded and stuff. And then, you know, I kind of just like the look of St. Petersburg a bit more. I know that it's not as traditionally Russian as, Moscow is. Like, it is more European. It's the most European city in Russia, but I just like the look of it. So I like living in St. Petersburg, but Moscow is definitely a nice place to visit.
Yeah. Well, that's something which has been observed by other people as well, that basically St. Petersburg is more or less a German town. It's not really quote unquote Russian. It's very European, and it might be the preserve of European civilization as we abandon it here in the West, as we abandon it in Europe. It might become frozen like a bug in amber the Russian, I'm mixing metaphors here, but like a bug, well, actually, no, there is a lot of amber on the Baltic coast. So like a bug in amber, St. Petersburg will remain a memorial to Western civilization, even if indeed the West goes under. So that's... That's an interesting perspective. Petersburg, Moscow. Have you seen the Russian countryside? And what can you tell us a little? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have actually. Last year, we'll get into the COVID stuff later. But last year, when there actually was a lockdown, but you know, I have a lot to say about this later. But so I wanted to get out of the city, so I. Someone I know lives in a village, and I went to visit them for a week. It was pretty cool. It was like a village with only 300 or so people. Lots of abandoned, Soviet industry there. So you see, like, factories, mine shafts, things like that. And it's a lot of houses that were abandoned. You know, you see the deindustrialization, you know. So Well, when the old folks in Russia complain about the end of the Soviet period and they're really nostalgic, I mean, I definitely see the appeal. You see that a lot of these places that used to have industry and used to have life kind of just fell apart. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed my time in the village. I actually went again this year, so I went there twice. It's pretty cool. It'd be a really cool place to shoot like a music video or a horror movie or something, because they have all these abandoned buildings that you can just wander around in and find all kinds of weird, interesting crap just lying around. You never know what you're gonna find. Like, I found a bicycle, or not a bicycle, a motorcycle helmet. I found a motorcycle helmet in one of them. You find a bunch of graffiti. I don't know why, but they're really fond of drawing penises on the wall in the abandoned buildings. But you know, although if the trade-off is that you don't get the LGBT crap everywhere, then I'll take that. You know, you can draw the penises in the abandoned factories in the middle of the countryside, but let's just keep the gay crap out of there. But yeah, it's cool. I met a Russian farmer who was drunk at 10 a.m. in the morning, a cattle farmer. And I just went up to him and I said, "Oh, hi, can I feed your cows? I have some bread here." And he said, "Yeah, sure. And I'm probably the first foreigner he's ever met in his entire life. He looked like he was in his 50s. And
probably 28.
Well, no, he remembered the Soviet time, so I think he was probably around back then. But yeah, you know, I don't know. I gotta say, sometimes I do feel jealous of the simple life that someone like him must live. You know, he had a cell phone, but it was like a jitterbug 2007 one that, you know, you have to press. I don't even know if you can type on that. Like, do they have a Cyrillic keyboards with the phones back then? I don't even know. So
I think they were around from the first smartphones, but I'm not sure. I did not have a smartphone until 2017, and I kick myself for, you know, allowing people to talk me into getting one. I did not want to get it, but my company at the time got it for me, and I've been stuck with the damn thing ever since. It's one of those things, I guess. Well, that's interesting to hear, because we got a lot of abandoned industry here in Macedonia as well. And I love exploring abandoned industrial capacities. And back in a previous life, almost, it feels like ages ago, I did a couple of videos here, a couple of live streams on DLive. That was on my own channel, not the Countercurrents channel, exploring abandoned shit. Just, you know, it's, I guess, kind of like the American Rust Belt. There's a lot of deindustrialization has hit not just the West, but also the East. And that's something to think about. Even Russia is moving into the service economy paradigm, which I guess accounts for the overpopulation of Moscow. Would you agree with that?
That the deindustrialization is because everyone's moving into the cities?
Do you think those two are related? I mean, personally, I think so.
I think so. Yeah, most likely. Probably is the case.
And not even the cities, but people are just pouring into the capital, into these nodes of globalism. You know, you don't even get them all spread out nicely throughout the country. Just people pouring into Moscow. It's Europe's largest city, right? Mm-hmm. Bigger than London, bigger than Paris. It's just one of those things, I guess.
Yeah. I've also been to the Ural Mountains. That was pretty cool. That was my vacation this year in January. It's almost a year ago now. But of course, you can't really fly anywhere because of, well, you know what? We're on DLive, you know, the flu world or COVID bullshit.
Yeah, we are on DLive and Odyssey, so you can just take Corona. Okay. I know you're still on YouTube, and Wolves has commented on this, you know, that some of the millennial guests who are still on YouTube are basically psychologically conditioned not to talk about forbidden subjects. So they'll say, you know, who's instead of Jews. They'll say the situation instead of the COVID tyranny. They'll say the medication instead of the vaccine.
But yeah.
For the time being, this is a free speech area. You can put your bonnet off and let your hair down with me, Endeavor. You know, I know you're not one of those girls. I will protect your honor, but you can be very free with me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm still on YouTube. Like my last video, I had to go the entire video without saying COVID or vaccine or anything like that. But anyway, so I went to the Ural Mountains in January because there was a guy that I met in St. Petersburg, and he was he's in his mid 40s. He was an officer in the Russian army in the 90s. So, you know, he's a pretty, you know, back then the country it was a pretty rough place. So you can imagine the kind of guy that he is. But yeah, he's from the Ural. So I, for my vacation earlier this year, I flew from, St. Petersburg to Ufa, which is, a big city in the South Ural Mountains. And then I met him there at 5 a.m. in the morning, local time. And we drove like 250 kilometers to his hometown, which has it's called Belaretsk. It has a population which means White River, has a population of about like 40,000. So not a big city, just a small town. And one of his friends had a flat that no one was living in. So I got to stay in this empty apartment for free, which was really cool looking, by the way, like it had a cool view of the mountains. And we went skiing together. It was minus 23 degrees about, freezing cold. I think I sent you some pictures at the time. The Ural Mountains aren't too tall, but they're real. The nature is really nice. There's trees everywhere.
Yeah, I was commenting on just how flat they looked, how low they looked. Because you know, maybe it's just a Macedonian thing. I'm used to soaring and inhospitable mountains surrounding me. But, you know, in the Balkan Peninsula, the terrain is just so rugged. Everything looks flat to me, I guess.
Yeah. So they're not that tall. They're not the Rocky Mountains, you know, at least not the South Urals where I was. We went skiing for a few days. We tried ice fishing at like minus 24 degrees. We didn't catch any fish, needless to say, but it was cool that I could say I did it. And there's this Russian dish. Have you ever heard of salo? Salo?
Does it mean fat?
Yes. So yeah, what you do is you take a shot of some hard liquor, so like usually vodka. You take a shot of vodka, then you get a piece of what's called salo. It means like it's salted pork fat. It's just pure fat and it's actually raw. So, and you put that on a piece of like dark black bread. We call it pumpernickel bread in Canada, but they just call it black bread there. And then you eat that after you take the shot of like the hard vodka. It is, hard as nails. I know it's actually a Ukrainian food, but
The black bread?
No, the salo, the fat.
I don't think you can tie pork lard to any place, really. I mean, I think every people which raises hogs consumes the fat. They are the most delicious part of the fat is the most delicious part of the hog. I will say that.
My go-to joke is that salo is the Russian sashimi.
that's interesting. I mean, I personally use pork fat, you know, lard for most of my cooking. A combination of pork and butter, of pork fat and butter, if I'm being honest, because I don't like the chemically derived seed oils and olive oil. I just prefer it on salads, not. And I've heard actually the thing you're describing, I've heard of it, and not just in Russia, but also here in Macedonia. But we associate it with, you know, poor people food. So I've not actually had salted pork fat on bread. I guess that's one of those things. And the vodka thing, well, if I ever come to Russia, I'm going to have to try it. But that's just me looking for excuses to tip vodkas over. So that's
I will say that vodka is actually surprisingly unpopular in St. Petersburg. No one I know likes it, actually. I think it's more of a rural thing in Russia.
It is, like I said, you know, when I mentioned Spengler, it's St. Petersburg is basically a German town, which is populated by, I mean, it is on ancestral Baltic lands. I think Karelians used to live there, some Estonians. It's also built on swampland. Dostoevsky notoriously did not like it. He saw it as an insane asylum. It is an imposition upon the Russian soul. So it's Russia's least Russian city, you could say. Maybe that's the reason. Maybe the architecture of the place just influences people. They think of themselves as more European than Russian. It could be possible. You ever get that sort of vibe from St. Petersburg?
I mean, I haven't spent that much time in other parts of the country, so I don't like know it as well. But yeah, it does look like similar to a lot of other European countries. Not that I've spent that much time in Western Europe. I've been to the UK, and I was in France when I was young, but that's it though. So, it's unique though, for sure.
Yeah, I've never been to Russia, like I said at the beginning of this show, but my favorite Russian author, right, is Daniil Harms. And he was from St. Petersburg, and he was notorious for many things. Well, his eccentricity to begin with, but he was also famous for being a local patriot. Like, he was very attached to St. Petersburg and Leningrad in his day, because he was a Soviet author. And sometimes you feel like you know the city just because I've read everything this man has ever written, and he wrote about his city a lot. And yeah, it's another thing you notice, there's not a lot of vodka mentioned. There's a lot of kvass being mentioned, a lot of beer being mentioned in. And Daniil Harms will often write about food and drink and these things going on in the communal flats. That's, I guess, a story for another day. Maybe someday I'll get you to... I'm sure you've heard of this. Like, when I speak to people who've been to St. Petersburg, they say that the city lives in the man's cultural shadow. Have you heard of this author, Daniil Harms?
No, I haven't.
That's a shame. That is a shame. Now, of course, we've talked about... And what can you tell us about Russian cuisine?
To be honest, it kind of sucks. I'm not going to lie. It's not my favorite. I kind of find it bland. There's a few things that I like. Like I mentioned, I kind of like salo. There's like a salad they call it Olivier, which is... It's all right. It's not great, but it's tasty. And to be honest, it's really not my favorite cuisine. It's kind of bland. The one thing I'd say the worst thing about Russia is the food. It's and also there's a lot of things you can't find at the grocery store. Some things that just aren't available. I love to cook, so I can. I used to be a cook, so I can still make myself some pretty tasty dinners. But I don't really cook Russian cuisine though. I just make my own things with whatever I can get my hands on.
That's interesting. Personally, I mean, this is one, if I thought about moving to Russia, you know, on account of, well, basically I think the West and even the Byzantine East are going to become unlivable for various reasons we're going to get into right now. But I thought to myself, look, you've been raised in a country where tomatoes regularly grow to be the size of your head and they taste like heaven itself. How the hell are you going to live in Russia? You know, my palate is just too Mediterranean for Russian food, I guess. I've tried making borscht and it was a little bland to me, so I had to smother it in cream and add bacon to it to make it edible. So that's one of those things, I guess.
I mean, I like borscht, but it's, again, it's not like it's not something to die for. You know, I'll have it every now and then at you know, some what they call the canteen. They call it a столовая. It's old, like the, so it's the, it's a restaurant in the old Soviet style where you have like this big line of different foods, and you just, you know, choose a couple that you want, and it's like really, really cheap and pretty good. It fills you up. But yeah, I there isn't like any Russian dish that I particularly love. So, not my favorite cuisine, to be honest.
Well, I guess, the final question I will ask you about, living in Russia is, you gotta tell me about, the women. You gotta tell me about the Olgas and the Oksanas and the, Svetlanas and all of the other, Boris and Natasha type stereotypical female names over there. How has been, let's address the Russian woman question, because the entire chat wants to talk about that, from what I can tell.
Well, they're beautiful. Some of the most beautiful women in the world, in my opinion. Let me just, I won't go into too many details here, but I've been more successful in that regard than I was, in Canada. So, definitely an upgrade. First of all, I mean, actually having, I feel trashy kind of talking like this. I don't want to sound like I'm some like third world migrant, but you know, actually having, opportunities to date white women. Whereas in Toronto, what you have is like, when I was in university, you'd walk into the lecture hall, with like, I don't know, 50 or 100, like say 100 people, there'd be like five white women in the entire room, and three of them are these like fat, ugly feminists. So there's like, in a room full of 100, there's two of them that you could potentially go for. And even then, you know, that's they're in obviously high demand. But I mean, there's definitely I'll just say the dating market. I hate that phrase, but it's been better. I don't know, but you know, it is, I guess sometimes Russian women are known for being hard to keep happy. I think that's true. You know, there aren't as many like, you know, awful feminists. There's a couple like, you know, idiots who are high on Netflix or something like that, but that's not the norm. I wouldn't say that, like, you know, they're like ultra traditionalist or anything like that. Maybe that might be the case in some like rural communities, or somewhere outside. It's not like that in St. Petersburg. You know, it's a modern city. Everybody has some kind of like 9-to-5 job or something like that. But you know, in comparison to what it was like for me in Canada, yeah, it's a huge upgrade in that regard.
That's the experience with a lot of people who talk about Eastern Europe, that basically the women are still feminine, but for how long? Because Eastern Europe is not really a haven from the degeneracy and the decay of the West. It's just delayed. It's just on a lag. It's one of these things. I was looking at someone on Twitter, and he mentioned that basically we in the East, that we have a poorer sense of timekeeping than Germans, than Northwestern Europeans. And I guess that could be considered true in some limited and reductionist sort of way by persons who have clearly not gone through enough beatings. But we are close behind the West in our march towards degeneracy. So that's something to be considered. But every Russian woman I've seen in my life has been, well, attractive at the very least. So I think Endeavor's judgment is better than Canada. Which,
yeah. What I mean, what I'll say is that like a 5 here would be like an 8 in Toronto, I'd say. So, you know, although I will say that, you also have to remember though, about like what you mentioned about like degeneracy. I mean, one of the best things about Russia is they don't have all this LGBT shit everywhere. That's one thing that's actually good. However, like it still has like really high divorce rates, really, not a very high, fertility rate. It's still below replacement. It's a bit higher than a couple of the countries in Eastern Europe, but not by much. I think it's like 1.7. I don't know the exact number. And it also has a pretty high rate of abortion as well. So, you know, it's certainly not certainly not escaping the plague of modernity, but you know, I mean, at least you don't have like the things that are just like intentionally put there just to, you know, at least you don't have the like just the satanic stuff, like the drag queen crap or stuff like that.
It's something of the, which just I keep coming back to because I'm from Southeastern Europe, so it's a little different here. But the thing is, right, the communist countries, the communist bloc, the Warsaw Pact countries, they did not refrain from degeneracy, right? There was still feminism in Russia, in Eastern Germany, in old Yugoslavia. There was actually state-sponsored degeneracy to a great degree here because the family as an institution is a parallel power center. An authoritarian and totalitarian government cannot brook parallel power centers. So the totalitarian governments of the Eastern Bloc could not brook this totalitarian, parallel power center, no more than the modern West can brook a parallel power center in the family. And of course, religion was completely ground down almost to nothing in the Eastern Bloc. It's one of those things. People are hoping that, I mean, it was from this Jonathan Bowden speech that the ice of communism preserved the cultures of Eastern Europe. Well, no, we are barely reconstructing our culture in the post-communist era from archives and from old stories and trying to resurrect our traditions in the modern age while at the same time fighting the Western paws. No, communism was not healthy for the cultures of Eastern Europe. It may have inoculated us and frozen some very macho behaviors in men, which lead to a pronounced honesty about our disgust with, you know, the worst of the degeneracy, but we are not far behind the West in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I would definitely agree with that. Communism is not something that was helpful for Eastern Europe at all. However, you know, I think that only in comparison, neoliberalism has been and global homo has been more destructive. It's just like, you know, it's like comparing, well, you know, I don't want to get into any like crude comparisons, but it's like comparing one pile of trash to another one. Like one of them is clearly worse, but it doesn't mean the other one is good.
It's like comparing rotting meat to rotting cheese. The cheese is going to stink worse, but give the meat enough time and you're going to get maggots. So, yeah, I'm going to do the bulk of the crudery here because Endeavor is a gentleman. He's been, and the Russians are very big on politeness from what I understand. So it might be rubbing off on him, whereas
Well, really, I thought it was Canadians that were supposed to be polite. I thought Russians were like aggressive and like stone cold.
Well, I don't know. My cultural impression of Russians was always that they are very reserved until they get drunk, and they're very
okay.
Polite,
yeah, that,
right?
Yes, that I mean, and depends how you define polite. Like in Canada, we define polite as like smiling and saying, "Oh, how are you? How is your day? Are you doing well?" That's like it's the complete opposite in Russia. You go to the grocery store and the person looks like they hate you. It takes a while to get used to, but you know, then it just becomes normal.
I had a book of Russian bon ton, you know, a Russian etiquette as a child, and it considers smiling at people unless you know them to be very rude, to be overly familiar. And to agree with that, and I understand this is a cultural difference. It's an American and Canadian thing that you smile at strangers, right? But in Europe, it's frowned upon, and in the East, especially in Russia, I think it's considered offensive to smile at strangers, right? It just shows too much familiarity. And Russians are reserved until they get drunk. Then they declare you your friend so they can laugh with you. And that's my experience with Russians, you know. Maybe I'm misjudging them, you know. You see them on vacation, you see them at their most raucous, but that's it. Now that we've gotten the fun stuff out of the way, Endeavor, unless you have something to add.
No. Well, I think one thing I would like to also add is like a positive thing is that I do like that everyone, not everyone, but most people you speak to have some sense of a culture that's not just global homo. So people have actually read Dostoevsky or Leo Tolstoy or something like that. They'll know who like their favorite czar was. They'll know they have like a decent grip of grasp of their history. So they, you know, you can actually talk to people about things that aren't, you know, cape shit and Star Wars. That stuff is here. Like there is that, you know, that crap, but at least there actually is a real culture that's remaining. I don't know. I hope that's able to hold out. At least they teach that they actually make the kids read it in school. So, you know, and instead of reading like, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird and a Diary of Anne Frank or something like that, at least they're actually, you know, reading something decent.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've read Dostoevsky, but I found him underwhelming, to be honest. Maybe I'm just a culturalist rube. It's one of those things, I guess. But we have super chats, and people have been sending our super chats. That's good to know. We have 20 American dollars from Tovarish Gadius Maximus. He says, Endeavor had one of the best videos of the year with the greatest frame game in history, and Gilby hosted one of the best debates of the year between Z-Man and Carl. This stuff is essential, folks, so support our guys. Happy New Year, gents, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you for that, Gadius. And I'm glad to, Gadius Maximus on his Building a Third Perspective channel on Telegram, which you should be following. So if our courageous comrade mods would dump that into the people's chat, comrade Gadius was his channel on Telegram, Building a Third Force. He did a retrospective of 2021 of the best, the most important things that happened, which are important to distance. And I'm happy that the debate I hosted on the writer's block between the Z-Man, who is in the chat with us right now, and Carl Thorburn on the subject of the political viability of Bitcoin was so well received. I was impressed, really, by the level of that debate. We had some really good things said over there, very informative things about the nature of money, about these things. But Endeavor, would you like to, give us a little refresher on the greatest frame game in history?
Sure. So I made that video in the summer this year. And I made that at like about the time that the Afghanistan war was winding down. I think I got the video out a couple of weeks before the big event with like the evacuation from Kabul. Basically that video was about how the U.S. political dichotomy was formed, and how like the point of the video is that Jews have basically worn the skin of the traditional American nation, like the historical American nation. They basically worn their skin and like use that as like a shield, so that all of the negativity that is directed towards America in the world is basically directed towards their enemy, that being white America. So, you know, when they go off and like George Bush is the perfect example of this. Like when George Bush goes off to fight like these Zionist wars, he's a guy from the South and with a Texas accent, and he says God bless America every now and then. So, you know, people say, well, it's you know, the rednecks in Alabama that are like going off and fight and causing these wars and stuff like that, when we all know who's actually behind it. Basically it's how the political dialectic was formed, and I demonstrated this through media. So I looked at like different films and TV shows and music over the last couple decades, and about how they kind of created like, you know, the neocon Civ Nat right versus the anti-establishment left. It's a pretty long video, it was an interesting one. I thought put a lot of work into it. And it's on my channel. It was a pretty popular one, so you can check it out there.
Yes, and we have I remember it just now, and it's really one of the great videos of the dissident right of this year on YouTube. I just remembered it. Sorry, we produce so much content. Sometimes it's difficult to keep up with it all. Even if you've seen it, even if you've enjoyed it, it's tough to remember it. And it's like I say to Mrs. Jilvy sometimes. She'll say, "Oh, I'm wearing that thing you bought me." I'm like, "Honey, we've been together for going on 10 years. I've bought you so many things over the years." Basically, I think 80% of all of the clothes she wears were at some point bought by me or whatever. I don't know if that's a good thing. I keep hearing from these game people that I actually shouldn't be buying women things. I don't know. We have donations, people. We have donations. We have an ice cream from Bartleby, and Bartleby absolutely dominating the chat as he's supposed to. Gulag Commander Bartleby, he's keeping a watchful eye for undesirables in the chats. We can't have those counter-revolutionaries. We have 1001 Cuts donating an ice cream and then a lemon and then another lemon. Well, thank you for that, kind sir. It is appreciated. It is greatly appreciated. And these tiny little lemons, they add up. Pretty soon we're going to have a whole dollar. And let me just refresh the entropy chat, the entropy page. Let's see if we have anything going on over here. Nothing for the time being. So, Endeavor, let's address the polar bear in the living room. How's the flu world order in Russia?
It's a really interesting story. I think that I probably have a very unique perspective on it. So, like I mentioned at the beginning, I got here before it, so I saw it before and during, and well, what's coming in now. What happened was in March 2020, they had a lockdown, just like everywhere else in the world except for Belarus and Sweden. So there was a lockdown. Now it was different in different regions. The way that the COVID stuff works in Russia is that it's each like individual republic, like which is like the different regions of the country, they get to make their own rules. So Moscow was actually initially like the one of the strictest. They had like people weren't allowed to leave their houses or something like that. It was pretty hardcore. It wasn't like that in St. Petersburg, but I look back at it now, I feel like an idiot, but I actually was following the rules for the first month or two of it. So there was a lockdown. Everything was closed for quite a while. I think you were still allowed to walk in the street. It was in the spring, so I was like going to the schoolyard and running and doing chin-ups and stuff like that and exercising there. So and then it that stuff all kind of started to end around June, July of 2020. So I just kind of went back to life as normal in June of that year. And then pretty much by July, August, everything was open. It was basically just life as normal. All the restrictions were gone, and it didn't take me very long to realize that, yeah, I'm just basically living life as normal. Literally nothing is happening. Everyone I know is doing the same thing. None of them are dying. There's no bodies on the street anywhere. And yeah, so it basically just went back to life as normal. And that was pretty much the case for actually about a year from I'd say July 2020 to July 2021. There was pretty much no COVID rules at all. They tried like this brief lockdown in New Year's of last year, but that didn't work really. It was really just like stores were everything had to close at 7 p.m. and I don't know why. It seems kind of pointless. And they even like shorten that. Like one thing they do is they keep like planning things, but then they keep like rolling back on their plans. So they keep they'll say that where they're going to introduce this restriction, then they always roll it back. So yeah, if so, for about a year there was pretty much nothing. And I mean, shame on me for this, but like one of the reasons that COVID wasn't the main focus of my content for that time was it really just wasn't on my mind in my day-to-day life. I was basically just living my life as I had been before COVID for a long time. And then, as I was wa I watched, like, for example, my home province of Ontario in Canada went under like one of the strict I think the strictest lockdown in North America for almost the entire spring. I think it was like 6 or 8 weeks that they were on like this full lockdown in the middle of the spring. It's insane when here there was absolutely no rules whatsoever. But then things started to shift around July of 2021. Now, nothing actually changed in anyone's day-to-day life. There's still literally nothing happening to anyone. You would, if you didn't have a smartphone, you wouldn't know that COVID existed. But then this is when the talk of the vaccine passport and the QR codes started to come in. As you know, they have their own vaccine. I'm not getting it. I'm not getting any vaccine. And I've made that point very clear. I don't care if it's the Russian one or the Pfizer one or the Chinese one. I'm not taking any of them. And that's the hill that I'm going to die on. But so for the first several months, the vaccine was basically just something that was completely optional, and hardly anyone was taking it. Like, no one was getting it other than a couple of old people and maybe, you know, some vaxtards, but hardly anyone was actually taking the vaccine. But then they started to bring this in with they started to bring it into some industry. So like some jobs required it. Some companies started to require their employees to get it. And we saw the first signs of the vaccine passport in July in Moscow. They brought it in and it only lasted 3 weeks until it was discontinued. It was just canceled. It just kind of failed. And then some people had suggested that they did that because there was an election in September. Not that the elections in Russia even really matter. It's worth noting that Putin actually lost seats to the Communist Party in the election. Not that I really follow that the parliamentary politics very much at all. That happened in September. Then after September, that's when, you know, I kind of started to feel the noose being tightened around my neck. Different regions started to implement vaccine passports. So that kind of started to come in October. And St. Petersburg, where I am, announced in October that they were going to start this stuff in November, if I have my timeline correct. Yeah, so they were planning on bringing it in November. Now, currently, they have the vaccine passport for movie theaters, museums, the gym, and sporting events, I think. I've never attended one of them. I've never been asked for anything like that, so I don't actually keep up with it that much. But they were initially planning on bringing it in for all the restaurants, cafes, and a lot of the retail stores as well on December 1st. But then that got pushed back to December 27th, which is today now. I mean, and then that got pushed. Now, when a couple of days ago, they pushed that back again to January 2nd. So it does kind of seem like a bluff. It does seem like they just kind of want to get it voluntarily. Though, you know, it does look like they're probably going to go through with it because other regions have it. I'm just talking about St. Petersburg right now. There's other places that have the vaccine passport, and it's been in effect for about a month or so now. I don't know exactly what's going on there because I haven't been there, but the worst case I've heard of in Russia is that the city Kazan, they're requiring it for the public transport. Now, I don't know how in the hell that city even functions with that in effect, but I mean, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that Russia is like one of the most anti-vax countries in the world. However, the bad news is, I hate to say it, but it does seem like the coercion's actually getting people to take it, because a lot of you know, the numbers have gone up since they've announced this. Like, a lot of people actually have now gone to get the vaccine, not because they give a damn about the virus. It's because of the coercion, really. It's because of the pressure that's being put on to people. And what's interesting is that all the COVID stuff, like, it seems so imperial, you know, almost at like a Christian mission in like South America or Africa, like hundreds of years ago. It feels like it's something that's foreign, that's been like placed into the country. And we know that that is the case, you know, that people like the World Health Organization, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they're the ones crafting these policies, and they're being implemented everywhere. But, you know, it's interesting because you'll still see the signs for like the meter and a half distance, like the social distancing bullshit. You'll still see those signs. Some places still put tape on the ground and stuff like that, but none of that's enforced. The masks, that's not enforced either. The only time that'll be enforced is on the metro. You have to put it on to get on. Then I just take it off 1 second later. And on the metro, I'd say maybe like a third of people have a mask on, maybe a third have it like around their neck, and then a third just don't have it at all. It's not, it's supposed to be a 5,000 ruble fine, but that's about like 80 US dollars, I think. Maybe, yeah. But
you see the distribution of masks vary according to age?
Yes, I do see older people wearing it more. They're known to like trust the media a bit more than the younger people here. I wish that was the case in the West, but nonetheless, the masks, like, that's barely enforced. Like, I never wear it. The only time is just to get onto the metro, then I just take it off 1 second later. And sometimes McDonald's or Burger King make you wear it's so fucking stupid. Like, what they'll make you wear the mask just when you get the food from them. So you have to go to the counter, put it on, get your food, then take it off. But like, you even see like that's like a corporation like McDonald's or Burger King. These are like global homo fast food restaurants. And you even see that like they're the ones that have been given the orders. They must have been given this from corporate to enforce this COVID stuff. Whereas, you know, the shawarma shop on the corner of the street, like they don't give a damn about any of that. So the employees at these places wear masks, but usually it's like down around their nose, you know, it's like not, they're barely wearing it. So what I think has really happened is, and there hasn't been like any official lockdown in more than a year. They had this like really brief attempt at it back in last year on New Year's. And then again, in St. Petersburg, at least they had an attempt at, it wasn't even a lockdown. It's just like the restaurants weren't allowed to seat anybody for 1 week in the beginning of November. And that was like meant to be like the period between that was meant to be like the buffer period when they're going to start implementing the Vax Pass. So what it seems has happened is that they've just said, because you know that like these institutions like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Health Organization are feeding them, these countries, the procedures of what they need to do. And you see that they've gotten these instructions, but they've kind of just said like fuck it with the masks, the social distancing, the lockdowns, just forget about that. Let's just go straight for digital ID. We're just going to go straight for the Vax Pass. Now, another thing that's kind of interesting is that they do seem to be giving away the QR codes for the Vax Pass like really easily, as in you're allowed to use a previous illness or something, or like a test for antibodies. I did one of these things, and apparently this code actually works, but I've never used it. I'm not going, I refuse to go to any business or give any money to any business that would ask for that, because that's humiliating. My honor is worth more than that. But it seems like they're giving those away really easily, which is in contrast to these other Western countries. Like it seems like it's almost impossible to get out of actually getting the vaccine. And in addition, I just lost my train of thought for a second.
You were talking about basically previous illness cards, which they give out with the.
Oh yeah, that's right. So interesting thing as well. Like you can see that like the system they had wasn't really well thought out, because, like to get into their vaccine passport system, not that I even want to, you have to have a Russian passport. So for people like me, there's no rules. Some places just won't even enforce it at all. Some places will allow any kind of vaccine, even including the foreign ones. Some of them will only allow it if it's Russian ones. Some of them just won't allow you at all if you don't have the passport. It's like it's almost as if when they were designing this system, they just forgot about non-citizens. So it's like you can see,
I wouldn't be surprised is the case.
Yeah, you can see it just wasn't really well thought out. So I mean, I've never gone to one of these places, but I've heard from other people that like they can just like show a random like a document of some kind, and they'll just let them in. So what I will say about like the Flu World Order is that they're trying to get it in. They're trying. However, it's not going nearly as smoothly. Like nobody other than you know the ones that seem to be the worst. It's like a lot of expats from the UK A lot of them that I've met have just been complete retards. Like a lot of them have been like the people that have been saying, well, what about this deadly pandemic? Or have you heard of the Delta variant? But like no one else has said this to me. There's very few people that actually care about COVID. Everyone's just living their life as normal. I've met, you know, one or two vaxtards, but, you know, all in all, nobody gives a shit if you're vaccinated or not. So it seems like they're trying to get this stuff in, but it's not working nearly as well as it is in Western countries, but they're still trying to force it through. And I don't know if I should say exactly what I'm doing, but I am fine. Let's just say there are ways around even the current system. There's some unofficial activities which, you know, you can get around it. So it seems like they're trying to get the flu world order, and they're trying to get this digital ID and stuff, but it's not working out as well.
Yeah, well, of course, you are a complete gentleman and would not even think about those unofficial ways of doing things, Endeavor. And I'm sure that's an interesting thing that Frodi Midjord was discussing yesterday on his Christmas stream with American Krogan and Semiagog, and you were there too, right? Oh, Endeavor?
Yeah, I was on the stream last night. I wasn't there for the entire thing. I was there for about an hour or so.
I fell asleep after you logged off because, well, you know. Anyways, it was interesting. Like let's call them second world countries like Russia, or third world countries like wherever American Krogan is. The problem of the flu world order might run into the problem of enforceability. Like basically they're going to encounter populations which are already used to bending the rules and working through the system. They're going to encounter systems where it's more important to actually extract bribes from your position in the system than actually do your job. It would be interesting to observe the flu world order trying to impose itself on any the whole gamut of state dysfunction from Russia to Burkina Faso. So we should observe that. Whereas I'm really afraid for our friends in Western Europe, where, you know, in Germany, where the system is going to be imposed with Germanic efficiency. And that's one of those things, I guess. So your overall impression would be that they're handling this in the typical Russian commie style?
As in poorly?
Yeah.
Yes. And that's in this world that we're living in now, that is a grace from God. I mean, I would hate to be okay, you know, say what you want about like Canada or Germany, Switzerland, Austria, any of these countries. They may be like just, you know, insane libtards, but at least they actually know how to run things. And in this world, that's like the worst thing possible, because you know that if they're actually going to design this like biomedical tyranny, it's actually going to work. So I wouldn't say my neck is out of the noose, but by any means, I'm still looking into, you know, escaping the city eventually, and then, you know, finding my own place to set down roots. I haven't decided where that'll be yet, but it's certainly, at least right now, a good location to be. I mean, I'm under pretty much no pressure to get vaccinated. At the job I work online, but at the office which I go to like only once a month, by the way. they were saying like that, like somebody I that someone who works there like meekly mentioned, or she basically like suggested that this vaccine thing, and I just said no, I'm not taking it, and she just meekly kind of like accepted. Oh, okay, I'm sure that'll be fine. So, and I haven't heard of, and that was like back in September or something, and I haven't heard from it since. So I'm guessing at least I won't be getting pressure from that in that regard. And also the other good thing is that I don't think I'm on like that like state registry or whatever it is. So I guess like they won't, I won't be the first person they're hunting down to vaccinate. Whereas in Canada, if I was in Canada right now, they'd have like an app. They'd have me on like this list. I'd be like barred from anything, from going anywhere. And,
right.
Yeah, it wouldn't be pretty.
Yeah, I was listening to Robin Riley on Millennial. She's in British Columbia, I think, on Vancouver Island. And I usually put on Millennial to put myself to sleep because, soothing voices and whatnot from the content creators. But that one gave me indigestion. It was so bad. Not that Robin Riley or Woz's performance was bad, but just so blackpilling. And just the way in which the Canadian government and the BC government treat people was stomach churning, literally, in
Oh,
my case.
it's just it's unbelievable. Like I thought Canada was insane, in 2019 when I was living there, but my God, like I can't even imagine like what it would be like if I went back now. For example, my family didn't visit their relatives for the second year in a row because of Omicron, or the moronic variant. And it's just so weird because I've been living my life for the last, over a year and a half, as if this COVID stuff is just irrelevant to my day-to-day life. And at least on paper, the official numbers, Russia has like one of the worst statistics. I think the statistics are just bullshit. I think they're just making it up, if I have
Yeah,
to be quite honest.
I read somewhere that I think the World Health Organization, they give money to governments based on caseload, and that really put everything into perspective. Like, why Macedonia has all of these cases? I'm like, yeah, they're bullshitting because they want money. It's so I don't know if that's the case, but if it is, it would explain why so many second and third world countries are reporting record numbers of COVID.
Yeah, I mean, the worst thing is that, just seeing, I am kind of, you can say I'm kind of like bitter about Canada and the way the country went, but at the same time, I do kind of have some affinity for Ontario, and just seeing the way that they've just seeing the way that they've treated their the citizens. Like a few of the cases of like children dying after getting the vaccine, like that for me was just, oh man, like you think like the place you grew up in, and it's incredible that what it's become. I know Canada's like been on the libtard path for decades now. We'll probably be discussing this next time we talk, but I mean, it's just like gone off. It's just gone off the rails. I just look at Ontario from the outside as if I'm like observing a fucking mental asylum at this point. Like they're out of their minds, but it just there's no end in sight for any of it.
Yeah, I think if I were Canadian, I don't know what I would do, because that's the thing. And I don't know how it's going to be in Macedonia with the COOF and with the restrictions. But I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't like the idea of moving away from my place of birth. Really, I don't. It's harder for me because I'm European. In Europe, we don't tend to move around as much. And I don't know. I don't know how these things are going to go, but
Yeah.
if they put your back to the wall and you have to choose between living in a foreign land and losing everything human about yourself, I don't know. It's a decision that would rend my heart if I had to do it, and it I don't know if I'm going to have to do it in the coming months. So let me just read the donations here. We have a Ninjagini, the first Ninjagini of the night from 1001 Cuts. Well, thank you for that, kind sir. I'm going to put my Ushanka back on, and I'm going to take it off for you, just for you, kind sir. That is a very nice. And by the way, I'm really vibing with this Ushanka. For those of you who are just listening, or maybe getting the radio replay, I'm wearing one of those Russian fur hats with the flaps tied to my head, because I'm just cool that way, and I'm really vibing. It really keeps my head warm. You don't really realize how much heat you're losing through your head until you put one of these things on. Now, it is electrifying my hair, which is a bit of a bother, but nothing I cannot live with. And we have 14 lemons from Slog, and from what I can tell, the chat is abuzz with Finnish activities. So Endeavor, do check the woods nearby. There could be snow infantry nearby. And I remember Simo Heia from all being told. Mm-hmm. Let me just double check the entropy page and see if we have any donations there. None yet, but there is an older donation from some time ago from Horator 21 for 200 euros. And he asks, I guess he asks Countercurrents in general, have you watched Millennial series of podcasts this year? Have you noticed new talent? What were your favorite streams? Endeavor, would you like to take a detour from our discussion of Russian issues into this? Are you watching Millennial?
Oh, am I watching Millennial? Is that even a question? Of course I'm watching Millennial. It's the Dissident Right Christmas Party. And fourth year in a row, I've gotten my invitation. My slot was pushed back from the original one, but I'll be on tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
Yeah, don't miss Endeavor. And I too had problems. You and I both, we both had technical problems on Millennial. I was supposed to go on the 21st, which was the winter solstice. I would have greatly appreciated keeping vigil with woes in the longest night, but it was not to be. So I got pushed, I think, for the 22nd or 23rd. I don't remember. Anyways, we had a good time with woes, and I hope you... And I'll reserve my judgment on a favorite stream until they're all done. But I don't know. We'll see.
I'm working my way through them, like, chronologically.
I still haven't seen all of them. You know, it's a lot of content to process, really. And you see them, and you also have to process them. I have no idea how Woz does it. I mean, this thing I do here, these 2 hours every week, and they take a chunk out of me, I'll tell you that. All I can say is I appreciate Woz. I think I'll have him on after he recuperates on the writer's block to discuss some more frivolous topics. But, that we're thinking about the future. And from that, I want to segue into the last of the Russian issues I wanted to discuss with you, Endeavor, is we've heard some disturbing things about the demographic situation in Russia. Now, it's nowhere near as bad as countries in the West, but the younger generations in the Russian cities, specifically in Moscow and St. Petersburg, from what I understand, they are... A disturbingly high percentage of them are non-white, and even some of the white ones are, you know, Muslim Chechens or Dagestanis, who are racially, maybe you count them as white, but they are of the Muslim faith, and that adds a layer of problems. So would you comment on anything you may know about the demographic situation in Russia?
I haven't thoroughly studied the official statistics. From what I gather, the country is over 80% ethnically Russian, and then there's other ethnic groups like Ukrainians, Belarusians, and then some other ones, which are of course Ukrainians are white. I think they're the largest ethnic minority. Maybe it might be the Tatars. Which are another large one. They're kind of borderline. So in terms of how white is the country, it's pretty good. Pretty good. As good as you pretty much can get. I mean, it's not it's not Iceland or anything. There's still lots of different ethnic groups everywhere. And it also depends on where you go. Where you are in the country. So if you're out near Central Asia, it's gonna be more Central Asian. It really depends on where you are. There's actually some places where there's a large Korean diaspora in Russia from when they were deported in the Stalin era out of the Far East. And then you'll have a lot of immigrants from places like Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. Those are two common ones. But all in all, from my perspective in St. Petersburg, the city is, I'd say, if I had to estimate, I'd say 95, maybe 93
percent white, and then like that would include Russian ethnic Russians and then other whoever else that might be. I'm just going by my observations on the street. In terms of like the younger generations, I don't know the official statistics, but there is a school that's like there's a few schools in my neighborhood, and sometimes you see the children out with their class, or I often go running in the now since I'm banned from going to the gym because I don't have the vax pass, I go running out in the snow at minus 20 degrees Celsius, but you know the flu world order is not going to stop me that easily. But you know,
Mother Russia is going to make a puny Scotch Canadian very strong. Maybe like Comrade Lermontov, you stay with us, become Russian.
Oh no, Canadians can handle the cold more than Russians. I think everyone always asks me, "Oh, how are you not so cold? How are you not so cold?" And I always say, "Well, I'm from Canada. It's kind of normal for us." I thought it'd be the same. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent here. Anyway, but there's this like school that I often run by, and from my observations, I'm not standing out there like staring in at the school kids and stuff, but the school seem almost entirely white. There's a couple, you know, Asiatic kids in there, but at least in St. Petersburg, to go off the demographics of the schools that at least I've observed in the neighborhoods that I've lived in, it's pretty good. I think it's about as good as you could really hope for. I'd say it's probably at least 90%, maybe 95%. Because I think also another thing is a lot of the migrants are from places like Uzbekistan and stuff, but a lot of them are just like migrant workers. So oftentimes they don't like bring families with them. I spoke to this one guy who was from, I think, Uzbekistan, but his family was back there. So a lot of them come to the country to work, but they don't actually bring their families. So that doesn't actually like affect the long-term demographics, which is good. However, I've also heard other things. I've also heard other stories about from Moscow. I haven't been there in a while, but I spoke to a woman who was a geography teacher in Moscow, and she said that her classroom was about 65% ethnically Russian. So I think that would mean there's a sizable proportion who are either, you know, Muslim or Central Asian or something like that. So it is cause for concern. So, you know, I'd say it's not as bad as in Western Europe, or certainly not as bad as in North America, but still is not ideal. And then, as I mentioned, the fertility rate is below replacement. So that is it's cause for concern long term. So I'd say if I had to like give to sum it up, I'd say better than other countries, but still, you know, they'll face the same problems that all these other countries will too.
1.7 is the overall Russian fertility rate.
I haven't looked it up recently. I think that was what it was.
Because the fertility rate of Chechens and Dagestanis and all these Muslim minorities, it's significantly higher. So if 1.7 is the, you know, the entire Russian Federation, that's actually cause for concern.
Yeah, it is.
See, that's the thing, right? People are, it's not the percentage, it's the dynamics. It's the rate of change, which is important, because you can have a country which is 80, 85, 90% white. If the white birth rates are low, that's going to change in a single generation, in 40 years, maybe.
So I mean, like, for example, Canada was up until the 90s, it was well over 90% white. It's changed overnight, really.
That's really the strange thing about Canada. I remember films from the 90s, right? The only good film Michael Moore ever made, Canadian Bacon, you know? It's one of my favorite films because I saw it when I was very young, and it had amazingly good and creative subtitles. So this was before I spoke English, so I really bonded with it because the characters with the subtitles, they spoke based in Macedonian to me. That's the thing. And these people, they presented Canada as basically being a whitetopia where Nordic presenting white people would go and frolic in this land of politeness and everything functioning properly. you know, as opposed to the Rust Belt post-industrial town of the American characters, which was somewhere on the border, I think in the upper peninsula of Michigan. And I always thought of Canada as, wow, this is basically a place where people like me live, people who appreciate politeness and order and cleanliness. Where is this magical land? I wouldn't mind living there. And by the time I'm grown up, I hear all of these strange things about Toronto. I mean, Armenians running people down in the street with vans, and Toronto being like 150% Indian. What happened?
Well, that all changed in the 90s very quickly. Like, they just opened the floodgates and basically changed like the entire identity of the country, that like basically our only identity now is just basically replacing us, that like we're smug about replacing ourselves faster than Americans. Pretty much. Like, it's incredible how I mean, well, you know, you can even see this stuff now with like the flu world order, but it's incredible how like quickly Globo Homo back in the 90s was just able to cut straight through Canada and almost just like convert it as if it was just like flipping a switch. It's actually probably even more incredible seeing it done to countries like Ireland today, where it's like, you know, America took a couple decades and Canada took maybe one decade. Ireland, it took like 3-4 years, you know. But yeah, they've been able to basically turn the country, transform the country beyond belief in just less than a generation, really.
I speculated that it's because Canadians, for whatever reasons, they tend to be more conformist than Americans, maybe even more conformist than Western Europeans. I think it's part of a dual, selection pressure due to living in a harsher environment than Western Europeans or Americans. And I think the second reason is founder effects, because the bulk of, heritage Canadians are American loyalists. And loyalists, of course, will tend to be more constitutionally conservative, which means conformist, obedient to authority, as opposed to the revolutionaries who remained behind in America. And that's another founder effect, because the American Revolution was a selection pressure on the Anglo and Scottish populations in the North American continent. It just silted through. The more constitutionally conservative people, they went to Barbados and Canada, the more rambunctious people remained in the United States. So, but this is something I haven't really looked into. I should probably look into the behavioral patterns of Americans and Canadians.
I would say that does seem accurate from my observations.
Yeah, it is a speculation, right? I have to look for data to back it up, or just look at the data and not go on a fishing expedition. That's what the flu world order does. It does not follow the data. It just follows a theory and finds data to back it up. And when there is none, they just manufacture it. So I should not do that, I guess. And with that, I think we have exhausted the Russia portion of our conversation endeavor. I thank you for this. It was very educational. A lot of our guys have misconceptions about Russia, and I think we cleared up some of them.
Yeah, and it'll help me out, because I've gotten dozens of questions about just this very topic. So, you know, I'm glad I can finally talk about it.
Yeah, you can now direct people who ask you questions to the Writer's Block. The Writer's Block every Sunday at 22:00. That's 10 p.m. Central European time. And we have Donskoy 2 donating 4 diamonds and saying, great show, guys. Well, thank you for that, Donskoy 2. You're a real hero, so for donating these diamonds to us. Thank you. I take my hat off to you. I take my Ushanka off to you. And Bartolo 76 donating 1 ice cream. Thank you. That is greatly appreciated. He says something about warm blanket of in-your-face corruption, unchecked, even glorified. Yeah, we're going to have to take refuge in corrupt regimes, apparently. God bless poor governance, because in the era of global governance, only poor governance is going to save you. That's one of those things, I guess.
Yeah, amen to that.
Yeah. But Endeavor, aside from running around in sub-zero weather and learning the hard way that Ubabu Volostolog but Aum Korotok, you've also been doing some tremendous work for the movement. You've been reading some very old literature. You've been reading The Moral Equivalent of War by a certain William James. And you even did a video on the subject. So if you would summarize it for our audience, if you will.
Yeah, so I came across this speech from 1906, which was turned into an essay titled The Moral Equivalent of War. And it was just kind of uncharted territory. I hadn't seen anyone else in our sphere actually touch this. So I thought I'd stake my flag in it and, you know, be the first mover on that one. So basically in 1906, there was a American philosopher, psychologist who gave us named William James, who gave a speech at Stanford University. And this was early 20th century. So before World War One, rising militarism, Japan and Germany were becoming these imperial powers. You know, Britain was expanding its territory. America was expanding. And he basically saw that like this militarism was going to lead to war. When he was young, he saw that he witnessed the American Civil War and the destruction. So James was a pacifist and like a utopian pacifist, someone who wanted to abolish war altogether. Now, I would say that don't get him confused with like some like peacenik submissive. Like I don't think he understands. I'll get into this in a second. But so he gave a speech about what he called a moral equivalent of war. So how can you because he understood the value of war. He understood that war fosters the martial virtues. It creates the warrior archetype. It gets society to devote itself to civic virtue. One thing he says is that every men willingly pay the war tax. Every man wants to belong to a conquering nation. Military service is a man's first duty to his nation. And he understood the value of war, really, the values that are derived from it. But he wanted to find a way to achieve that without bloodshed, pretty much. And what he proposed was that a war against nature. So he proposed that men be, instead of being conscripted into militaries, they'd be conscripted into these workforces, and they'd be sent off to build these railways and skyscrapers, and they'll dig these mines, and they'll just like build up society. This is just at the end of the Industrial Revolution. It was the early 20th century, and there was still a lot of there's still a lot of space to expand into. Still a lot of new frontiers that people could envision building towards. And that was his proposition. What he said was that could foster the warrior spirit without, you know, sending men off to die in wars. And what was the quote exactly? He said it would bring discipline without, or authority without cruelty, discipline without callousness. And what I wanted to do was apply this to the present day, because what we have today is that the problem that we have is not that we don't have this horrible threat of war, but the problem is we don't have these warrior virtues. Because the problem that James addressed was that the rising militarism of the time was going to cause a war. But the problem we have today is not that there's going to be a war, that is that we lack the martial virtues. And I applied this thinking of ways that like COVID and climate change are being used to kind of instill this new kind of civic virtue into this very twisted version of civic virtue into the population by giving them this great struggle. So, you know, everyone wants a great struggle. Like war is the greatest of all struggles. And James proposed this struggle against nature in its place, because all men want a great struggle. And kind of climate change and COVID have been brought in as these fake struggles that are getting the population to conform to a new kind of morality for the agenda that the globalists want to implement. And what I proposed was that from our perspective, I don't think there's going to be a war. I think there'll be like unrest in a lot of these countries, but I can't really see a civil war happening for several reasons. But I have always found it kind of depressing that we never had our great struggle. And I kind of thought of James's proposition. I don't believe that, you know, a struggle against nature can maintain peace in perpetuity, but I thought of like the process of us, you know, building outside of the system, because with all this like vaccine passports and mandates coming in, eventually like our guys are going to be locked out of this system with this digital ID, this global surveillance. Eventually, you know, we're going to not have all of these, all the luxuries of modernity. The overabundance is probably not going to be available to us. And I thought, you know, just like us building our own communities, building maybe it could be our own businesses, could be, you know, us eventually having to like grow our own food and stuff like this. This can actually foster, you know, civic duty to one another. And it can foster those like masculine warrior virtues, you know, living without the living without the overabundance of modernity and getting back to actually, you know, physical labor and working together. I think that is something that we can really kind of find that we can really reclaim a lot of the virtues which we have lost. So that's what I took away from the moral equivalent of war. I know that was a bit long. I know it was almost as long as the video itself, but yeah, that was my my take on it.
Yeah, it is a fascinating essay. It gives us a window into the thinking of American progressives at the time. Okay, so James was a socialist, but he wasn't a Marxist. He was looking for compromise. He was looking to implement his program into the real world. And this is very rare in the modern left, and you could say it was rare even in his day, but he actually took the time to read and listen to what the militarists, as he calls them, were saying. And he conceded that, yeah, these guys are right, that there is a something in the human animal which craves conflict and struggle, right? And that, so he looks for this moral equivalent of war, something that will... I'm almost reminded of Richard Dawkins talking about the God-shaped gap, right? He understands that man has something in his soul which is filled by God. And then quite stupidly, you know, Dawkins says that maybe we should leave this thing empty, because by filling it with God, we have the various religious wars and the, you know, the new atheist, he just repeats the new atheist screed. But it was interesting to look at this.
Yeah. And what's fascinating about James is that, now one thing that was also interesting, I listened to the LibriVox recording. It was the one I sent you, but then one of the essays that one of the, text versions of the essays I found on Google, actually, like it was prefaced by saying like, his sexism and racism would be, unacceptable today, but we should still like listen to him, which basically tells you just how base the guy actually was.
Yeah, even a progressive pacifist, like he sounds to me like the type George Orwell would call a sandal wearer, fruit juice drinker, nudist feminist, you know. And but even guys like that understood the fundamentals of man against woman, and they understood nationalism. They understood that men love their nation, and especially the working class love their nation. And they did not seek to, destroy the nations. At that time, leftism was still concerned with preventing war between the nations, war that which they saw as unnecessary.
Yeah, and, I mean, yeah. I don't know if I would call James a socialist, but...
Well, he called himself a socialist.
Yeah, it's very socialistic. Like, he definitely has socialistic leanings. He's not... I think you made the caveat. He's not a Marxist. He's not calling for like revolution or anything like that. But you can definitely see the socialism in like enlisting the population to go off and do these public works campaigns. But you know what I found,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. This was actually done by socialist regimes in the Warsaw Pact en masse. They called them work actions. They would actually gather up the youth and have them build roads and bridges and factories. His proposal was put in practice. And when you think about something like the moral equivalent of war, I was immediately reminded of basically the leftist British beating their chests about the NHS or Swedes being all smug about Sweden as immoral superpower in their accent, you know. So this is actually which has been done. We're reading a white paper which was implemented.
Yeah, but I you know, the most fascinating thing about the essay really is I'd say what he says about the martial virtues, that like one thing is he says that even because he was a pacifist, but he criticized other pacifists at the time. So for example, socialists that said like, well, it's capitalism that's causing war, and that it's just the working class against the ruling class, or you know, that it could have been some capitalists who said that well, we need a peace economy. So economic interdependence, that's going to prevent wars from going to, that's going to prevent countries from going to war with each other. And what James criticized was he said that like without a moral equivalent of war, without something that siphonsifies the warrior spirit, pacifism is neither possible nor desirable, really. So he understood that this was something that is innate in man, and that it is something that's inherently valuable, which is why like he talks about at the beginning of the essay, one thing I thought was so fascinating he said was that if in the America of the early 20th century, nobody would dare to fight another American civil war. They'd be horrified by the idea of fighting another civil war. But then if you said to them that they could erase the American Civil War from history, nobody would agree to that either, because the memory of that great struggle was so cherished by the America of the early 20th century that it was something that they would never want to forget. Like it was something that had shaped their country, and it was something they had great admiration for. While people would obviously recognize that they would never want to fight a bloody war like that against each other again.
Which is interesting, because in the present day, the left is busy. Well, they're not really erasing the memory of the Civil War, but they're erasing the memory of the Confederate South. You know, so they're unthinking or unpersoning the Southern Americans, which is just white Americans. It's a war on white people, which begins with Southerners. That's something to keep in mind, that a socialist pacifist fruit juice drinker 100 years ago could not bring himself to imagine forgetting the Civil War, and yet is this history is being erased before our very eyes right now. And
and what I'd say is that like why my proposition would have the advantage over theirs. I mean, I know we don't have the resources they do, to say the least, but because the great struggle, like having a great struggle, is some way to get the population in line, which is why things like COVID have worked so well. You know, like I don't think they'd be able to implement any of this stuff without some kind of great crisis. You know, they want a digital ID, they want this global surveillance, they want this biomedical tyranny, but they need to have this like great struggle that allows them to bring that in. And then eventually they're going to switch over to the climate change. And what I said in the video is I think that COVID is going to act as the foundation myth for the climate change era, the same way that World War II acted as the foundation myth for the, you know, the neoliberal global homo era. Not that global homo is going away, it's evolving. But, you know, what I said in the video, though, is that what James said about like the warrior ethic, all these like fake struggles, like, you know, in Britain worshiping their NHS, or Sweden being a what do they call it? Humanitarian
moral
superpower.
Okay. I'm sorry to any Swedish people in the chat, but your accent is just infinitely amusing to me.
I've always thought that people like Henrik and Frodi sounded pretty cool.
Henrik has lived in America for so long that you cannot really see it, and Frodi is Faroyar. He's not Swedish. I think the thickest Swedish accent in our circles is Marcus Follen,
the golden one.
Yeah.
Okay, but
I think he has the thickest Swedish accent, and I think he's from rural Sweden, somewhere in the north. So that may be a factor too.
Yeah. So, like these fake struggles that the powers that be are pushing right now is their moral equivalent of war. They don't foster the warrior virtue, and the warrior ethic is something that is a constant throughout history. It was the same in ancient Greece as it was in 1906 when James gave his speech. What these fake struggles foster is weakness. Like, what it's created in the population is people who are literally afraid to step outside their house without a piece of cloth in front of their face to get 3 fucking injections because they might catch a cold and get a runny nose. Right. I mean, that's what they're actually saying about the moronic variant right now. These fake struggles foster weakness. Whereas, yeah, you know, our potential struggle, and I want to say that, like, we actually have the potential now to make this not a LARP, because, you know, you can just say on the internet, like, our struggle for the white race, you know, but until it becomes action, it is a LARP. But, like, you know, eventually,
I think that what differentiates a real struggle from, because I have an article up on Countercurrents called "The Struggle Is Real," where it does not really deal with so much with finding a moral equivalent to war. It's just a warning that some people who are in the dissident right might be in it for wrong reasons. They might be seeking self-annihilation through struggle rather than meaning through struggle, or actually want to achieve something. But I think that struggle in the absence of death is meaningless. And I think this is why Global Homo could not mobilize itself on the back of climate change. Everyone just ignored Greta. And she's not even the first messianic child to preach the Gaia's gospel. You know, they had one of these in the 80s or 90s. I forget. I forget the child's name, but it was even there was even an homage to it to a game from 2000, which was Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, which is my all-time favorite video game. But, you know, that's a story for another day.
So, because climate
change does not have mortality salience, right? Corona, dying of COVID, people have died of COVID, so there is higher mortality salience than climate change, right? But the struggle we have against Global Homo, against demographic replacement, against the flu world order, against these things, it actually does have a chance of us being killed, because eventually there are going to be fines, there are going to be arrests, and you're going to be thrown in prison, right? And that's the thing. It's something that I think it gives our people a good reality check to. When we say we are dissidents, we are not kidding. Greg Johnson was arrested in Norway during the Skanza Forum in Oslo in November of 2019. People have been arrested in the COVID protests. More and more dissidents will come in conflict with the law, and that with it will always carry the risk of imprisonment and death. And this is how you know our struggle is real, that it's not a LARP, because you have skin in the game. You can lose teeth. You can lose, you are in danger of life and limb doing our thing. I have been getting some pretty serious fucking death threats here in Macedonia for trying to spread the gospel of Carl Schmitt. It's one of those things, I guess. It's the mortality salience, the reality that you can die doing this thing, which makes the struggle real and which forces you to develop valor as a means of overcoming the adversity. I think if you're fighting against phantoms like climate change or the Omicron variant, you're really just fostering just this tiny all-fearing creature within yourself. Like you said, it breeds weakness, but mortality, the presence of death, mortality salience is what's so important about having a genuine struggle which can bring out the best in men.
And, you know, what I think is a really good opportunity for us right now is that with the vaccine, it's a binary. You either do what the system wants you to, or you don't do it. And if you don't do it, then you're taking a step into the unknown. And that takes conviction, really. And it's a chance that we really have to actually stand up for something. Like, you know, a lot of time for years, people were saying, well, what can I do? You know, okay, I know I understand these issues, but how do I do something? Well, now is a time where you actually have the opportunity to make a stand. And if you make that stand, it's going to cost you. I mean, there's no way around that. You're going to be accosted for not taking the vaccine. And you're going to be cut off from a lot of the excesses of the system that we live in right now. Like things are going to be physically harder, but you know, actually having to like go out into the unknown and actually having to build something, like I in some ways I'm actually excited about this. You know, like I like St. Petersburg, but I don't want to live here my entire life. I want to you know, have somewhere where I can do physical labor, like farming or construction or something like that. Like I look at someone like, you know, the Amish. Now I'm not going to go full Amish. I don't think I could ever do that, but you see the videos of like the entire community building a barn for like a new family or something like that. And you see like 50 men working on this one project at once. And, you know, there's more of like a warrior spirit. There's more civic virtue in that than anything else in Western society right now. And that includes joining the actual military. I mean, just look at these Western countries. Their militaries are a fucking joke.
There's a togetherness. Let's not throw the warrior word around. Like I said, unless you militarize your psyche and actually experience death and gunpowder, I don't think you have a right to call yourself a warrior. This is why I don't call myself a warrior, right? Yeah. I'm a fighter.
I've never called myself a warrior either, but it is able to like foster some of the same virtues. Or another one is like Arania. Like it's inspiring, really, seeing they're able to build their own communities. It's all handmade from the ground up. You know, when it's amazing that, you know, just when our people are given a chance, we're able to create something extraordinary every time. All we need is that chance. And, you know, the problem is that the system is absolutely determined to not give us any chance anywhere in the world. But, you know, if we're given that chance, then we're unstoppable, really.
That's, I guess, one way to look at it. So this is, like, I agree with you, Endeavor, that this is kind of like a moral equivalent to war, but I think it's far closer to actual war than we are willing to accept. I think it's far closer to actual war than the enemy is willing to accept. People have been debating in the regular chat while we've been talking about the possibility of war breaking out. And I think there is a genuine possibility of large-scale war breaking out, maybe not because the flu world order, but tensions are certainly high between Ukraine and Russia. And the question remains whether, you know, America and the Western allies, the NATO pact, will support Ukraine in a potential conflict against Russia. If they do, how far will they be willing to escalate the conflict? It's we live in interesting times, and that's something to think about. That's something maybe not to look forward to. But also, our struggle against the flu world order, against demographic transformation of our nations, this is something which far better approximates actual armed conflict than, because you can have scars to show for your struggle, and that's something that makes the struggle real. Now, I'm not, of course, calling on people to do anything stupid or illegal, but it is. I would just want to give full accounting to. So if you're a guy who's just coming into the movement, if by any chance you're listening to this, this is not something you can do as a video game. This is something you should probably devote your life to. No, I'm not yeah, you can just contribute casually sometimes, but to understand that there are risks, there are real risks, and you also, this is one of the very few places where you can experience actual struggle and hardship in the modern West if you refuse to bow down to these diktats. I agree with you there, Endeavor, but we need a little nuance to look at that. We have been getting donations, however, and people seem to be very satisfied with the work we're doing. Well, we didn't say the struggle is going to be all bad, folks. Sometimes there are perks, and Alaska Chaga has donated a ninjet over on DLive, and a ninjet, that's 10 ninja guineas, that's 10,000 lemons. Well, thank you for that. That's, I believe, an Aeroflot jet, because we are doing a Russia stream, of course. And Tovarish Alaska Chaga. Alaska Chaga is, of course, Russian America. People have noticed that I don't say Alaska. I say Alaska, which is the proper Russian name of that American state. And they get that wonderful fungus there, which they turn into tea, which you drink and turns into antioxidants in your body. And this is why I'm still so sexy at my advanced age. And thank you for that, kind sir. I am certainly enjoying your product greatly. It's really cold here. I mean, not Russia cold, but it's one of those days where you really just want a cup of tea and to curl up by the central heating unit and discuss struggle and the moral equivalent of war with good friends. Let me just refresh the entropy page and see if anyone else has donated. See what's going on over there. Well, no entropy donations just yet. Oh, hold on a second. Yeah, no entropy donations just yet. And I think we have 4 minutes left, Endeavor. Let me just ask you one last thing, because people have been debating it very vigorously in the chat. What do you think is the probability of armed conflict breaking out over, well, any of the issues, like excluding the Russia-Ukraine thing, which I don't think either of us knows a lot about that. But do you think the political strife in America, is that going to spill over into armed conflict?
No, I don't think it. Well, it depends what you mean by armed conflict. I don't think there's going to be like another American Civil War, just because like there's no different like sides, really, like there was in the first one. That you would need like two different sets of elites like going to war with each other. That's pretty much how civil wars usually happen. So I think there'll be unrest. I think that like a lot of these places in America they'll have unrest. But I don't think it's going to be like a full-scale civil war, like certainly not like it was in the American Civil War. And I can't even see that like something like the Spanish Civil War happening. So no, I don't think there will be an armed conflict. And I'm not hoping for that either, because I don't think that's because people have to understand like that's probably going to result in more of us getting killed than anything. And there's no guarantees of success, certainly when we don't own all the guns. I mean, I know that the American, like the right wingers in America are more armed than the left wingers, but they don't control the military though. I think there'll be unrest. I think there'll be like skirmishes, but also our goal really should just be to be as far away from that as possible. Like, I'm not someone that's going to say like, you need to be on the streets of Los Angeles when shit starts to go down. And you should be building your own community, anywhere that you can be secluded from the worst effects of global homo. And then when something happens, you want to be able to defend your community. So certainly I'm no pacifist. I think that, you know, using force to defend what matters to you is perfectly just. But I don't think we're going to have like this great like crusade or anything like that. I don't think there's going to be a war like there was traditionally in history. I think, you know, maybe some unrest, but ultimately our big job really needs to be to build something that's viable and sustainable, that we're able to escape the system and actually sustain ourselves outside of it. I think that's like what we really need to look at, not any kind of civil war.
Yeah. So that's a very interesting, that's a good perspective to have. Let me just say this, do not fetishize the aesthetics of war, right? Because we're talking, of course, about the moral equivalent of war. The danger I see in this approach, which our enemies, Global Homo, knows of this text, and they actually practice this, so this is very important. But it can also be practiced by controlled opposition groups who mean to shanghai your instinct towards the military, towards military valor, for nefarious ends. And I think the phrase in my notes is word for word, instrumentalization of warrior aesthetics and the will to thumos for merchant ends, which is always a risk. Our enemies are masters at misdirecting our instincts and using our virtue against us. So do not fall into those traps, is what I'm going to say.
Yeah, that's actually what I talked about a lot in the greatest frame game in history video.
Yeah. And I mean, we influence each other, Endeavor. It's that's the beauty about being in a movement, in an intellectual movement, having a robust salon culture. It's not just you get a bunch of smart people. You get a bunch of smart people and you get them talking to each other. You get them influencing each other. And that's how we win, ultimately. All we got to do is not get squished for another 50 years, I guess. And that's my long-term prediction, I guess. Have you got anything to add, Endeavor?
No, I think we covered it. It was a good stream. The video is on both my Odyssey and on my YouTube, but I'd prefer you go over to Odyssey. Mm-hmm. So definitely check that out. I have some content coming up in the new year. I will be on Millennial tomorrow night, so don't forget to check that out. And thanks for having me on, Nick. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for accepting the invitation, Endeavor. Thank you for informing us on Russia and for discussing this very important text with us. Now, I want to thank everyone who watched. I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank the absolute champion of donations, Alyaska Chaga with the Ninjet. I want to thank 1001 Cuts and Donskoy. They're the 1, 2, and 3 top donors on DLive today. I want to thank our heroic comrades, moderators, Bartleby and Gadius Maximus, who have kept chat completely clean of counter-revolutionary elements. And I'm dropping the accent now, people. It's never happening again. Cross my heart and hope to get the vaccine. And, of course, I want to thank everyone, really, who I think I already thanked everyone. So with that, let's say bye-bye. This has been The Writer's Block. Bye-bye.